Informed sources said that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Iran holds a state funeral for its renowned nuclear scientist who was killed in a terror attack near Tehran on Friday. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon threatens legal action if London blocks a new independence referendum next year. This is World News from our Tehran studio with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Top story: informed forces to say that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The sources say that remnants of Israeli-made weapons were found at the site of the incident near the capital, Tehran. Now, this while Iran officials had already announced that traces of the Israeli regime's involvement were found in the assassination. The authorities have pledged to revenge the murder of the renowned nuclear scientist. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated on Friday when his car was ambushed near the capital, Tehran. Iranians have laid to rest the body of the renowned nuclear scientist who was assassinated on Friday. Fakhrizadeh was buried in northern Tehran. A state funeral was held earlier in the city, where senior government and military officials were in attendance. Addressing participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami said that assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister promised a crushing response to perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Hatami urged Iran authorities to bring to justice those who carried out the attack. Fakhrizadeh headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research. Our Tehran correspondent Salman Kujuri says that such moves, like assassinating Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, won't hinder the nation's move toward progress.
As senior officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran have always said, and the Iranian nation has shown over the past couple of years, such martyrdoms, actually such assassinations, will never hinder the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Iranian nation, from its path of progress. And such assassinations and any kind of grudge against the Iranian nation will make way nowhere. This is the word of the Iranian nation and the officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And such assassinations against top Iranian nuclear scientists will inject fresh energy into the will and the resolution of the Iranian nation to continue strongly the path of development and progress. And this is the main message of the Iranian nation and the Islamic Revolution of Iran to the outside world, especially those who are against the scientific progress of Iran, the scientific achievements of Iran.
Now, journalists and commentators say Mohsen Abbas says that U.S. President Donald Trump wants to get away with murders before his term comes to an end in January.
Well, firstly, the Trump presidency obviously is coming to an end. He seems to be conceding. So there's a lot of speculation that in the last month or so, he can basically get away with murder. He has got away with murder already. We know what happened to General Soleimani, for instance, on a diplomatic mission in pure daylight, they assassinated an Iranian official. The same forces have essentially done this on Iranian soil now with the scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Whether they deny it or not is irrelevant. The fact is the deep state exists in order to create scenarios, to create situations where war or certain political engineering can be executed in the interests of the Western imperialists. Now, of course, the ramifications for the area are the same as they've been for many decades now. Ever since the Islamic Revolution has come onto the scene, it's been a game changer, and the ramifications primarily for the illegal state of Israel are its absolute termination.
Now, several European human rights envoys have criticized Saudi Arabia for its continued detention of women's rights activists. The European rights ambassadors have criticized the kingdom for referring the cases of two women activists to a special court for terrorism charges. They also urged Riyadh to release the women, including Lojain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. The two were among many jailed during a 2018 operation targeting prominent opponents of the kingdom's former law barring women from driving. The crackdown happened on the order of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman just weeks before the ban was lifted. A number of detainees accused interrogators of subjecting them to torture. The Hathloul family also accused the authorities of threatening to rape and kill her. In other news, Palestinians have held a protest rally in a village in the West Bank against Israel's decision to raise it to the ground. The rally was part of events to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mona Kanda reports.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
French media saying that four police officers have been charged over beating and racially abusing a black man in Paris. Two officers will stay in custody while the other two will be placed under judicial control. On Sunday, Paris prosecutor Remy Heitz said the charges against the officers would include the use of racist language and intentional violence with weapons. The victim, music producer Michel Zeckler, says the officers attacked him for no apparent reason while he was entering his studio. The incident resulted in violent clashes during rallies against police violence in Paris on Saturday. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab says that the UK and the European Union are heading into a very significant week for negotiations on a post-Brexit trade deal.
I do think that this is a very significant week, the last real major week subject to any further postponement of the goalposts in terms of the timing.
Meanwhile, EU negotiator Michel Barnier has described the current talks as an ongoing process. Months of negotiations have failed to bridge differences on competition policy and distribution of fishing rights. Without a deal, the $1 trillion trade between the two will be at risk. Britain's transitional EU exit agreement is set to expire on the 31st of December. London has time and again said it won't seek any extension. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has declined to rule out a new vote for independence from Britain next year. She says she wants to see a referendum held in the early part of the next term of the new Scottish Parliament. She warned that she may go to court for permission to hold a referendum if London tries to block it. Scotland's parliamentary election is due in May 2021, and the Sturgeon's National Party is expected to mandate a new independence referendum. Back in 2014, Scots voted against independence. However, Brexit and the British government's handling of the COVID-19 crisis have resulted in a new wave to push for independence from the UK. Most opinion polls show a majority now favoring secession. From London, I'm now joined by Saeed Purza. Saeed, looks like that Sturgeon is pretty adamant to go ahead with this independence drive.
Along with members of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, as you just said, this is happening on the back of some 11 polls conducted by online research companies such as YouGov and Ipsos, in which those voted yes for a second referendum on independence from the Union or from the rest of the UK. Have had a narrow lead, in some cases up to 58% lead over those who rejected the idea altogether. So this is something, obviously, is going to be front and center in the May elections, parliamentary elections in Scotland, which is 6 months from now. Before a second referendum happens, they will have to have the blessing to the go-ahead, rather, Minister. And the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, if they were to go ahead and hold it. And I say a second referendum because, as you just said, there was this.
Well, we don't have a very good connection, unfortunately. We'll try to get to Saeed Purza later on. Now, the top U.S. health expert has warned that America should prepare for a surge upon surge in COVID-19 cases in the coming weeks. Anthony Fauci said in an interview that an uptick in coronavirus infections is inevitable following the Thanksgiving holiday travels. The same concerns were echoed by the U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. But warnings were made as U.S. officials say that more than a million people traveled through the state's airports last week, marking their busiest days since the pandemic started. The United States is the world's worst-hit country by the virus, having logged 266,000 deaths and 13.3 million cases. President Trump's administration has been criticized for issuing conflicting messages about mask wearing, travel, and the danger posed by the virus. Colin Campbell says that additional COVID-19 surges in the U.S. are quite likely. Many Americans have not changed their lifestyles yet.
That's right, and of course this is going to happen because we haven't made significant changes in our lifestyles for the past several months. So the manifestation of what our practices and our principles and our behaviors is going to show up later on. Well, a lot of people think that because of a change in administration, there will be a change in behavior and a change in culture. But with that, there are those who are worried just how much that will impact the economy. With many people who are losing their homes or losing their businesses, the sustained closure of businesses and the truncation of lifestyles will further impact how people will deal with the economy. And so even though a new administration may show indications of a lowered spread rate of the virus, it may adversely affect the economy as well, which I think a lot of people are worried about.
Well, as for the news on Scotland's First Minister Sturgeon declining to rule out a new independence vote from the UK, I was talking to our own Saeed Purza in London, and we didn't have a very good connection. Hopefully the connection is fixed. Saeed, back to you.
Thanks, Behrouz, and my apologies. You asked me whether or not Sturgeon was adamant, and the answer is yes, he definitely is, and she takes her determination from some 11 polls that have been held recently, in which the people, the pro-independence people, have had a lead over those who have rejected the idea altogether. It's in some cases up to 58%. And that is a marked difference from the 2014 referendum, the first referendum on Scottish independence, in which more than 50% voted against breaking away from the Union, from the United Kingdom. And these studies have been, the polls rather, have been conducted by reputable online polling companies such as YouGov and Ipsos. But for a second referendum to happen, they will have to have the go-ahead from Westminster, from the government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and his government doesn't seem to be sharing that idea at all. But really, the question of independence, the Scottish independence, never left the political scene in Scotland. It was never put to rest, and it has continued to be the dominant question in Scottish politics since. But the noises got louder about a second referendum on independence after the UK voted for leaving the European Union in 2016. But it's important to mention that at the time, the Scots voted to stay in the European Union. So that really explains the significant differences in terms of politics that exist between these devolved nations, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland. Of course, we're discussing Scotland now, and the rest of the UK, meaning England. So on the Brexit vote, again, the majority of Scots voted to remain in the European Union, 62-38%. I think that's really a big majority there.
Right.
So for a second referendum to happen, they're going to have the okay of the government. But the SNP, the Scottish National Party, will have to try and remain in power in the parliamentary elections to be held in May. Mm-hmm. And some are saying even if they don't win a majority, they will probably be supported by the pro-independence Greens Party that will sort of put them over the line, and at which point the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, can pick up the phone, call the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and say, you know what, I have a second mandate for a referendum. Then there is the issue of the pandemic. Health is devolved, meaning these devolved nations are dealing with the pandemic, the fallout from it, in their own way. So the differences in which they have introduced measures in all the four countries. Mm-hmm. After all of this is said and done, the question remains whether or not there will be a second referendum on independence. That is really the million-dollar question, Behrouz.
Right.
Some of the SNP's leaders are restless. They want it to happen. They want Nicola Sturgeon to have a plan B, a strategy of some sort, to go ahead with it and see how England or Prime Minister Johnson will respond. There are also questions about whether or not the Scottish economy will be sustainable, what kind of currency they will be having, and also how will trade look like with the rest of the UK. So okay. You can bet it's there's no guarantee it's going to be held, but it's going to be in the conversation in this country for months to come. There.
Okay. Comprehensive explanation on that. Thank you very much, Saeed Pourreza, in our London bureau. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of sacred defense and the cultivation of talents.
One of the glorious acts behind the front lines was the decision of some people to stay in their cities, cities in Kurdistan, Khuzestan, and other provinces. Some people stayed in their cities while they were subject to the heavy and regular invasion of the enemy. The fourth point is that in the Sacred Defense Era, the most exalted virtues showed themselves. Both moral virtues and spiritual transcendence were witnessed during the Sacred Defense. One cannot really find precedents like this. Of course, there are a few examples here and there, but witnessing it in such large and massive numbers is really unprecedented. I know no other arena like the Sacred Defense in which we witnessed such moral characteristics, both moral virtues and spiritual transcendence, religious qualities and the like. The biographies written indicate the existence of such qualities. The same is true of testaments and other writings about soldiers' sentiments, sincerity, honesty and warmth are examples of moral virtues.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. They had purity and worked for God. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. They also exhibited humility and a spirit of serving others. We have frequently read in biographies astonishing events narrated by soldiers. For example, such and such a battalion were sleeping in their tents, and when they woke up in the morning, they saw that all their boots had been polished. Who had polished them? It is not clear. After doing some research, it becomes clear that their commander had collected their boots and then polished them, or that he washed their dirty clothes, or that he had washed the toilets. These are astonishing events. Such was their humility and their spirit of rendering service, doing altruistic things and sacrificing themselves.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah. on the news line.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK, as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation? But the question is, just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation? Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker than ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Dahr in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates, and immediately snatched, kidnapped, and taken back inside for another six-month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes. But they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
The French police are one of the toughest and most brutal in Europe when it comes to the use of force, with multiple examples of this demonstrated by the likes of the Compagnie Républicaine de Sécurité, or the elite CRS, when dealing with the various waves of protests that have marred the presidency of Emmanuel Macron, and is why the French public and media have turned to real-time technology to film the brutality demonstrated by the French police and security apparatus. The resulting anger demonstrated in various protests across the country against the bill has quite rightly angered the French, who expect some form of transparency in the way their country is run, how public services such as the police deal with situations, and also important is the notion of being able to justify such use of force, which, as we saw in the US with the murder of George Floyd, only takes a moment's lapse in concentration to breach the thin blue line. With the ability to film and photograph any moment with the use of a smartphone and cameras, the French appear to want to hide the actions of the police, meaning Article 24 of the new bill now makes it illegal to distribute images of police officers on duty, especially if it may harm their physical or mental integrity. But what about the integrity of the officers themselves acting out their duties? Should that not also be something that should be open to scrutiny? A recent example of police brutality in France is the recent removal of migrants who were camping in Place de la République in Paris's 12th arrondissement, in which bystanders and witnesses described the amount of force used by the police as shocking, once again raising the question as to just what kind of security apparatus the French government wishes to deploy. But for many lawmakers in France, the introduction of the bill is also being met with some opposition, in particular within the French Parliament, with one lawmaker claiming that whilst it's acceptable that police officers should be able to complete their jobs without being threatened or harassed, at no point should public freedoms be breached, claiming that this bill may not change much at all, even when introduced. When the people took to the streets during the French Revolution, the motto following the toppling of the bourgeoisie became indoctrinated into the values that France still claim true today, namely the famous three words of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, or freedom, equality, and fraternity. Yet today, in modern France under Macron, all three of the coined terms appear to have less meaning, as the freedom to film the actions of the police in public places has been taken away. The equality between classes grows ever wider as Macron protects his elite friends from taxes at the expense of the poor. And fraternity is a joke as religious, racial and social discrimination run rife in France. The division in France has never been greater when it comes to religion, with France currently embroiled in yet another controversy as the publication of offensive cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad had been labelled as freedom of speech by Macron, much to the distaste of many who have taken to the streets around the world to protest this, and leaving religious leaders in France calling for some notion of unity, proving that Islam is a religion of peace. With Macron also causing huge division within France on other fronts, with the increase in duty on fuel sparking the Yellow Vest movement, and the failed policy on reforming the pension scheme costing the regular worker thousands of euros, it seems that with every step Macron takes, the more unpopular he becomes, with the so-called security bill just passed protecting the police, further cementing the fact. It can therefore be argued that Macron is the most unpopular president France has ever had, even surpassing the legacy left behind by François Hollande, as he divides his country, favours the elite, angers the international community, and essentially washes away his chances of being re-elected, needing a miracle over the next 2 years if he's really able to save his extremely fragile grip on his country.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with clergy and the students of the seminary. Choose a teacher or morals for yourself. Arrange sessions for advice, counsel, and admonition. You cannot become refined by yourself. If there is no place in the seminary for moral counselors and sessions of advice and exhortation, it will be doomed to annihilation. How could it be that fiqh and usul jurisprudence and its principles should require teachers for lessons and discussions, and that for every science and skill a teacher is necessary, and no one becomes an expert or learned in any specific field by being cocky and disdainful, yet with regard to the spiritual and ethical sciences, which are the goal of the mission of the prophets and are among the most subtle and exact sciences, they do not require teaching and learning, and one may obtain them oneself without a teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini, in which he said that, "Whisper to your heart that everything you do is done in the presence of God." It is very important to pay attention to this saying, because we all believe in God. We all believe that He has created us. If you ask any believer, any Muslim, does he believe in the existence of God? He says yes. Even the people from different religions, they also believe in God. But obviously, the mode of believing is changed. It depends how they believe on what type of God. Being a monotheist, we know that there is only one God and He has created us, and that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we ask Muslims, when we ask ourselves that, do we believe in the existence of God? We say yes, and we bring different proofs in order to tell, because we believe in Allah, these are the proofs. So with different logics, we prove that Allah do exist. But the point which Imam Khomeini is making in his sayings, he says, whisper to your heart as well. Yes, you believe in God. Yes, when you believe in God, you tell everyone there is only one God. And we say, La ilaha illallah, there is no God except Allah. But the point is, what you say with your tongue, do you really believe with the heart? Do you whisper to your heart that you are in the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
يا حي يا قيوم
يا حي يا قيوم
when you say Inna Lillah wa Inna Ilayhi Raji'un, we are from God and we will return towards Him, do you whisper this to your heart? Because if you are whispering this to your heart every day and in every single moment, you will never take wrong steps in your life. Your steps will be taken in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your steps will be taken in for the divine cause. Your steps will be for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that is the main point which Imam Khomeini is trying to make. He says, we know that you say you believe in God, but you need to whisper this to your heart, because the things that we believe from heart, when we whisper things to our heart, then we are taking steps towards those things. Those things that are whispered to our heart, we take steps for those things. It is very important that you do things with heart, with belief, with your whole self, with your all powers that you have, and that cannot be done until unless you whisper something to your heart. We need to whisper to our hearts that everything we do are done in the presence of God, and that God is watching us. So inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to understand these things inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
The U.S. economy is not doing well. So are the economies of many countries across the globe. So what makes the U.S. different? Well, aside from having the highest infection rate in the world, it may have a new president. Incoming President-elect Joe Biden, if confirmed, as reported by the media.
As I said on Saturday, I'm humbled by the trust and confidence the American people have placed in me and in Vice President-elect Harris. And we're ready to get to work addressing the needs of the American people. Today, that work begins. It starts with doing everything possible to get the COVID-19 under control.
Yeah, key word there, control. But will Biden and his team be able to deal with a problem that is so severe, a problem that has just ravaged the U.S.? One of the consequences, hunger. Check this out. This is what's going on at an L.A. food center.
Pre-pandemic, we measure things in pounds, and we were distributing about 1.5 million pounds every week in and out of our distribution centers. And now we're running at 4 million pounds a week coming in and out of our distribution centers here in South L.A. and Commerce.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Atwaib. In this week's episode, we will take a look at the U.S. economy, how on earth it can climb out of the economic downturn, mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and whether the current U.S. president or the incoming president-elect, as reported by the media, have a game plan to tackle this monumental challenge. Now, first, let's take a look at President-elect Joe Biden. He has said that business and labor leaders has signaled willingness to operate to fix the U.S. economy. He also stressed that the coronavirus first must be brought under control. He said more people would die if President Donald Trump continues blocking a U.S. transition of power. The incoming president-elect also urged Congress to pass relief legislation. As of the recording of this program, no relief deal in sight, as crucial pandemic relief programs are due to be shut down by the end of the year. Now, U.S. Congress needs to act fast. For the first week of November, this is a reason why they need to act fast. The U.S. has registered a total of 742,000 new applications for unemployment compensation. Now, that means tens of millions of Americans are out of work. Now, how is the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, be able to bring back these jobs. American voters did not elect Joe Biden because they thought that he would be the best man to revive the economy. The economy may well define his presidency nonetheless. Biden will take office in January amid a crisis brought about by the pandemic, which is capable of causing immensely more economic harm before vaccination is widespread. He will also inherit a business landscape in the throes of a once-in-a-generation shift, as technology becomes more embedded in everyday life and in more industries, a shift that has been simultaneously hastened and overshadowed by the disease.
Biden's program is very, very well targeted to be able to reverse the economic downturn, because what it involves is a lot of spending at the local level to improve infrastructure, to change the mixture of sources of energy, to provide for local social services, to attend to the health problem, and to reinstate programs for worker welfare.
Whether Biden succeeds or fails depends on how he manages these twin sources of change. Make no mistake, it is not like the U.S. president-elect lacks experience dealing with economic woes. When he became the vice president of Barack Obama in 2009, it was the depth of the Great Recession, with the U.S. economy having lost nearly 3.6 million jobs the prior year and still shedding jobs at a rate of 800,000 a month. But the U.S. economy now faces different challenges than in 2009. The basic question here is, how bad is the U.S. economy doing? I mean, it's very simple to see that if we were to break down the numbers in the different economic sectors that show the depth of the crisis. For starters, the unemployment numbers. It is estimated that over 30 million Americans may have lost their jobs. Now add to that the millions of workers who were out of the jobs or out of their jobs before the pandemic. That number could creep up to 40 million easily. Keep in mind, many unemployed have given up work and are not being recorded. Then comes the poverty rate. The official poverty rate in the U.S. was registered at around 10% for the year 2019, before the pandemic hit. Now, when the $600 a week bonus unemployment payments stopped, poverty rates actually increased. Latest figures indicate about 7 million people are now living below the poverty line. Again, keep in mind the variance, since many are not being reported. And finally, what about economic growth? At one point, the U.S. GDP drop in 2020, in the second quarter that is, was the worst in its modern history. It was down 32.9%, that being the largest quarterly drop since the Great Depression. And since then, the U.S. has regained just two-thirds of that figure. Biden has repeatedly said that before America could rebuild its battered economy, it needed to get the virus under control.
COVID, it's a terrible disaster. The United States right now is the largest loci for infections, and now has surpassed 250,000 deaths.
The coronavirus has affected almost every country around the world. Many have taken an economic hit this year as a result. However, while citizens of other countries generally agree on how to move forward, Americans have a wide ideological divide that could make Biden's job much harder, as presidents often draw on public support to help push their agendas forward.
Economic recovery, his view of economic recovery is a recovery that's based upon doing something at the very, very grassroots level. And that's extraordinarily important to reverse the kind of top-down corporate subsidies, corporate welfare that the Trump administration offered.
The survey conducted over the summer found that among citizens of economically advanced countries struggling to contain the virus, Americans were the most polarized along party lines in their assessments of the government's response to the virus and the economy. Furthermore, another poll from October revealed that only 24% of Trump supporters said that the coronavirus outbreak was very important to their vote, compared to 82% of Biden supporters. Conversely, 84% of Trump supporters said that the economy was very important, versus 66% of Biden supporters. Biden has promised to follow the advice of public health advisors, even if they recommend shutting down businesses. Biden's supporters may applaud that approach, but he will find it challenging to convince the rest of the country that it's the right way to go, especially Trump's most ardent loyalists, many of whom have shunned even basic preventative measures like masks. The congressional situation is a major obstacle for Biden's agenda as well. The U.S. president-elect may get only parts of his broad plans spanning everything from child care to infrastructure to climate change through a gridlocked Congress.
Okay, joining us in the studio today is Craig Holman. PhD serves as a Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. Now, Craig is an expert on campaign finance reform, governmental ethics, lobbying practices, and the impact of money in politics. Previously, he was senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice, New York University School of Law. Craig, welcome to Economic Divide. The U.S. President Donald Trump's economic plans were deemed a success before COVID-19. But right now, we're looking at a massive economic devastation. For example, unemployment at an all-time high, pretty much. Business bankruptcies also at an all-time high. Increasing poverty. President-elect Biden, once confirmed, has focused on spending with a lockdown to incur beforehand. Do you think he's going to be able to jumpstart the economy?
Biden's going to make every effort at jumpstarting the economy. And I suspect when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, he will succeed on this. Biden has laid out his plans, first things first, and that is number one on his priority.
Okay. You say disastrous Trump administration. Biden has focused on four major areas to transform the U.S. economy: COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. Are those four areas going to work?
Well, there's his whole program is different than what we've seen with the Trump administration. Biden has laid out his economic plans through the course of the campaign. At first, he's going to focus on working class interests, which, by the way, is an absolute reversal from the Trump administration. Trump has favored the very wealthy. He's given tax cuts to the wealthy, tax cuts to the corporations. Biden plans on reversing those tax cuts to the wealthy.
Okay, you apparently are very pro-Trump, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. Are you looking at Biden's economic initiatives in which the transition team says it wants to mobilize American manufacturing and innovation and build a modern infrastructure for clean energy?
I was mentioning that one of Biden's priorities is infrastructural development, and that includes energy along with roads and bridges and the entire infrastructure that makes the economy operate. Biden has pledged so far to spend about $1 trillion on developing the infrastructure for the U.S. economy.